Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With the rising price of oil turning into massive profits for oil companies, and it's the same for gas companies as well, of course, is it time to ask those companies to pay a windfall tax to reflect the gains they're making? Or is it, as the British Prime Minister has argued, a disincentive for these companies to invest in the future, for example, in renewable energy? But can we really let them enjoy higher profits whilst lower income earners struggle to heat their homes? A windfall tax, yes or no? That's today with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby, and this is the Debunking Economics Podcast. Well, a big debate that's happening in the UK right now, and I'm sure it's going to happen around the world if it isn't already, is whether energy companies, who are, of course, enjoying record prices, profits, I should say, with the elevated prices, should they be paying a windfall tax? So, for example, BP made $12.8 billion profit last year, $4.1 billion of that in the fourth quarter. It did make a loss in the first quarter of this year, it's fair to say, but that was because they had to write down their ownership of Rosneft, the Russian oil company. But the first 3 months of this year, Shell made $9.1 billion, three times the profit they made the same period last year, so that was an all-time high for them. In Australia, BHP made $9.7 billion profit in the second half of last year, 17% up on the year before, thanks to the rising price of iron ore. So they're making lots of money. Meanwhile, Gladys from Sutton Coalfield and Marge from Footscray, they're struggling to pay their energy bills. So should these companies be taxed for their extraordinary high profits, Steve? And, you know, that money go to those people who are actually struggling to pay the bills? Or is that all a bit of short-termism, do you think?
It's a bit like banks in some ways, in that why is an oil company an oil company? It's not because it invented the oil. It found the oil. But by far the major reason why it's profitable is something which existed long before humans even existed, let alone capitalism. So what you have there is a resource, which is that's the basis of our economies. We could not have an economy unless we were exploiting energy. That's period, whatever form the energy takes. And the reason we have the elevated economies we live in is because we're exploiting solar energy stored 100 million years ago by fossils, by plants, by animals, and so on. And that's what we're actually exploiting as fossil fuels. So in that sense, the thing which the oil companies did, you've got to go back a century and a half for this, is that they located the oil reserves and then worked out a way to use them. And of course, they've got an enormous amount of technology they've developed to drill it out of all sorts of locations on the planet. But fundamentally, the value comes out of the resource itself far more so than their technology. So there's every reason that they should because without them, our society doesn't exist. And without them, without them, the oil companies would not have a business.
Well, they do pay.
Paying a tax on them. Yeah.
Well, they do. They do pay. Well, of course, they pay a corporate tax, but also they pay extra. I think they pay an elevated amount of corporate tax. So it's 19% for most companies. Most energy companies are paying 30% of their profits. You might say whoopee-doo, but I think there's also royalty payments and stuff like that they make. The question is whether it's enough normally. But I mean, the point is, when you've got times like this where through no fault or action on their part, prices have shot up. And, the reason they've shot up is because there's an excess of demand because we're coming out of COVID. But more importantly, we've got a war, and that is limiting that's limiting the supply. So they're benefiting from these higher prices, which may last a year or two. So should we tax it? Should we say, well, okay, you weren't expecting that money. We think we should have it, not you.
Yeah, like what you've got with if you I think you have to very carefully distinguish between the fact that they have a license to exploit a resource which existed long before they turned up, and then they have technology and a distribution systems that are designed to get that resource to the rest of us. It's quite legitimate for them to make a profit on the latter. And you could say, well, what's the average rate of profit? That's what they should be earning. But the remainder, then there's, when the price will rise because of a war, they're misery capitalists, and that should not be something that goes to them. However, there's another side, and that is the volatility of energy prices in general. So if you try to set something on the basic idea that they should get the average rate of profit, there will be times when the misery capitalists coming along, they're crushed by capitalism. And one of the examples I know relatively well is what happened in America in particular, when the oil price, having risen from $20 a barrel to 40 back in across 79 to 82, then fell from 40 back to 10 again. And what you have is all these oil companies had borrowed dramatically to expand their operations, particularly in Texas. Everybody's thinking, oil boom's going to go on forever. And people extrapolated forward that price rise, So 40 bucks back in 1982 would be not too far distant from what we're paying at the moment, probably, in terms of the rate of inflation
in real terms.
Period of time, but far higher than happened one or two weeks later. And the banks that had lent to them, a lot of them went bankrupt. So this is what Richard Vague explains so well, because he actually lived through that process in a bank.
The argument would be then, wouldn't it? If you're going to charge a windfall tax when times are good, then you should be bailing them out when times are bad.
Well, but it's also, you look at the role of energy in a modern society, and one thing that you cannot do without in a modern society is a constant flow of energy. So we have all sorts of problems about this. It's an absolutely fundamental input. If energy doesn't go in, then nothing comes out. And of course, conventional economic theory is absolutely useless on that, because they have no concept whatsoever of the role of energy in production. So the last thing you want to do is have this tax being designed by a bunch of economists, neoclassicals. Forget
which
it.
Which unfortunately is what would happen. It's been a debate in the UK over the last week or so. It is all relatively new, this, because this hike in oil prices, we really weren't expecting, lot of what has happened in 2020. We weren't expecting inflation. We weren't expecting an invasion of Ukraine.
Can I throw in my favorite little line about this decade?
Yeah.
Okay. Because starting with 2020, of course, my line there was 2020. The fact that we use 2020 vision, was that something caused by a time traveler coming back into the past and trying to warn us?
Yeah.
But as people keep on hoping going to go back to normal, and my attitude is that the 2020s will be known as the hold my beer decade. Every year is going to be worse than the one before.
Oh, gee, God, I hope you're wrong on that. But look, Boris Johnson said, that he's not a big supporter. A lot of right wing politicians are saying. The argument that they give is that if you play with tax, then you deter investment in the very things that we need to be investing in, which, he sees as new technology for new energy supplies. But I don't know if that argument works.
Oh, you're going to trust the oil companies and the coal companies to do that, are we? That's fun.
Well, I mean, there's the thing. Why wouldn't they be doing it? And in fact, if they're hit with a higher prices and therefore higher profits, you would have thought. I mean, it's very hard to do, of course, to do it in a very short space of time. But wouldn't they actually be trying to plow as much of that money into research so that it's an expense, so they don't have to pay taxes on the profits? So the windfall tax would actually encourage them to try and reduce their profits, which would mean investing in new technologies, which is the opposite of what Boris Johnson thinks it would do.
Well, I mean, we're seeing in Australia, of course, during the election over here, an incredible increase in the number of coal projects and gas projects being approved. And the thing, it then comes down to, would you trust a coal and oil industry executive? I'm afraid I wouldn't.
To find an alternative source.
Because speaking with some people who've worked in the industry at various times, their attitude is this stuff on the ground. We want to get it out for the best price we can and flog it over time. So the whole idea, A, that it should be regarded as a resource for the whole of humanity, or B, that we should stop using it and leave it in the ground, they are not the first or second thoughts that occur to, you know, high-ranking coal and oil executives. So in that case, it's like asking the cigarette companies to handle research into lung cancer. I'm sorry, I don't trust them. And I think if you could trust them, then how the hell did they get to the top of the company in the first place?
So, but if they knew the writing was on the wall for them, and they probably don't believe that it is, but if they did, then they would be looking at alternatives, wouldn't they?
It's too late for that. I mean, and again, this is the role that the coal and oil companies have played in financing climate change denial. And of course, you know, I focus mainly on the role of economists in providing the arguments that justify climate change denial. But it's undeniable that the coal industries and the oil and gas have all been, you know, financing groups that push out this denialist literature. So there's neither sympathy nor trust coming from me about these guys.
I wonder whether, I mean, part of the reasoning for the windfall tax is, you know, as I said in the introduction, you know, you've got oil companies which are, and oil company executives which are getting richer and richer through all of this. And then you've got, Marge from Footscray, if you're an Australian listener, or Gladys from Sutton Coalfield, if you're in England. And, you know, they are struggling to pay their energy bills. So there's this elegant simplicity, isn't there, to say, well, okay, let's take that money, that profit from the oil companies, and let's give it to those people who are struggling.
That's where the elegant simplicity becomes too simple, and that is where the modern monetary theory argument comes in. Does the tax actually finance the spending at the other end? And the answer is it doesn't. Okay, this is the point which, you know, sitting through the Australian election campaign fairly actively this time because I'm running for the Senate, it's been frustrating watching all the arguments about you should use tax for this and use tax for that. Tax is a way of taking money out of bank accounts. It's not a way of paying for government services. Government services are paid for by government money creation.
And get that, Stephen. We've spoken about it so many times, and I'm completely with you on it. But it, just in terms of the understanding of the layperson, you know, you take money from one person to give it to another.
Well, in fact, you'd need to set it up that way. I mean, you wouldn't be talking a tax. You're talking an inter-non-government age person entity transfer scheme. So there'd be... Yeah.
Adjusting the money supply in any way. You are just... It literally is just a switch.
Yeah. You'd put a charge on the profits, which was then transferred within the banking system, so it doesn't actually end up being, it's not tax. Okay, so it'd be some form of windfall surcharge, and then you'd have to design it carefully because you don't want to go in the opposite direction. Okay, you don't want to low prices apply. Madge is then paying money to BP, so it has to be something thought out intelligently if you're going to not avoid.
Because there's the danger, isn't it? If Madge might be struggling, but there might be somebody else who. Is a high energy user who you subsidise, who then doesn't moderate their behaviour. And you obviously want, you know, you don't want Madge to change her behaviour because she needs to keep warm. Marge, sorry, it's to change from Marge. So we need a continuity person for this podcast.
For a short while there.
But anyway, whoever it is, this woman in Footscray, she needs the energy to keep warm. What we don't want to have happen is somebody who's using too much energy to be subsidised to the point where they go, oh, well, there's no need for me to change my behaviour. Because obviously, the reason why energy is so expensive is because there is less of it than there is demand. So we need to get that balance. That means somebody's got to use less of it.
Yeah, and you don't want to be, as you said, encouraging energy use at all. I think in general, it isn't just a case of not encouraging energy use from fossil fuels. It's not encouraging any use at all because just in terms of the aggregate impact we have upon the biosphere, we're using far too much energy.
We've got people in Britain who are sitting in libraries because they can't afford to keep their hands as warm. There was a story about a woman who's driving around on buses to keep warm, and then Boris Johnson's answer to that was, well, I did introduce that bus pass that made that possible for that woman. I mean, there's a man who's just totally out of touch with the whole thing. So you've got to make sure that the money is, if you are doing it, the money's got to go the right way. But I mean, I wonder whether, here's another reason why it's going to happen, is because, of course, what do you reckon? If you've got a company that, is given a slug of money, thing is, you can't, if you don't know, if at the beginning of this year, you really didn't have an idea of just how much oil prices were going to go up, so you really didn't have an idea of just how extraordinary your profits were going to be this year. I mean, you couldn't put it in invested into anything because you just don't have the time before you reach the end of the year. So what do you think they do with it as an easy and elegant solution in their mind?
Basically, to some extent, what the Norwegians do, and that is they're having a sovereign wealth fund. So when the money is paid in, it accumulates. It isn't all, you know, you don't pay it out to match unless it gets lower. Lower coal energy prices today. You try to keep those prices constant, and you then, so what goes through to the consumer is not the volatility that comes through in the wholesale market. Incidentally, that's one reason why market pricing hasn't been introduced for electricity in Australia. And I know this from working directly with the person who designed this. The system, because it turned out the price spikes were the major way that firms made their profits, and there were only 3 days. If you weren't operating for 3 days of the year, your company would be unprofitable, because on those particular 3 days, that's when the wholesale price went through the roof, and you made most of your money. Now they realized, they passed that on to consumers with that volatility that comes out of this artificial market that's been created by trying to deregulate the market. Rather than having central energy producers, that would mean that somebody would go to bed at night and wake up bankrupt, just because they forgot to turn the air conditioning off. And so they simply couldn't pass it on to the retail market. They had to keep it constrained in the wholesale market. So a similar thing here. You'd want to be setting up such a way that when those price spikes occurred, it went across to a fund, which in that case, that fund could be accumulating money, which was then used to finance research and development of non-carbon-based energy systems.
Yeah, almost like a future fund for R&D. Because we could say, you've got all this money. You won't pay tax on it. Put it into this fund, which, I mean, could be your fund, could still be the BP or Shell fund. But if you're going to avoid tax, then all of that money has to be additional research, which is going into renewables. And you need to, and then we need to make sure that you're not actually switching money that you're going to spend in renewables into this fund. So we need to ensure that there's a certain proportion of your total R&D expenditure which must go into renewables. If you want to take the benefit of this facility, then for all time, a certain proportion of your R&D expenditure needs to go into renewables. Then we'll allow you to spread your tax on this, as you say, it's like a sovereign wealth fund. I mean, that seems like a smart way of operating, doesn't it?
I hope so. I mean, you certainly don't want to give this money back. The last thing you want is more R&D and how to get more oil, gas, and coal out of the ground.
Yeah.
And that would be the first thought of most of the people working in that industry. That's all they've ever done for their lives. And it's what happens when you get inculcated in a particular culture. It's only if you escape the culture, like, Simon Marchow is a classic example there, getting out of the energy sector in Australia and now being the world's leading researcher, I'd say, on talking about what the implications are of trying to switch from the level of fossil fuel energy we're using now to an equivalent of what he calls mineral-based, and it just isn't possible. So you do get your renegades, but one reason why Simon's not working in Australia anymore is because he is a renegade. So, again, you cannot trust these companies to do the right thing themselves.
So you need to introduce it. Yeah, they need to be controlled. You need legislation. But that would be a way, wouldn't it, of saying, well, okay, let's soften the blow. If you get peaks and troughs, we'll allow you to manage putting that money aside without paying tax on it. But do you know what they do actually? And this is, we've seen this in a big way this year. These companies, they've got all this money. They don't know what to do with it. So what do? They buy back shares. So yeah, Shell is planning 6.3 billion in share buybacks from Shell this year. BP's planning 3.2 billion in a year. And when you think about what that does, so those shares, obviously there's less of those shares around. So, you know, if you want to buy into those companies, the share price goes up. So the investors are better off. The executives who are on share, have got options are better off.
Yep.
Gladys from Sutton Coalfield is still spending her days sitting in the library. Because the only place you can afford to keep warm, and all these people are better off as a result of a situation that they didn't create. So that can't be allowed, can it?
Well, it is allowed, unfortunately, and that's the trouble. Is what we get is the worst politicians money can buy, because people who are willing to suck up to that sort of behaviour are the ones who get funded for elections. I'm seeing, you know, again, sitting in Australia, actually being very poorly funded for the non-mainstream campaign. I'm running for a non-mainstream party, TNL. You watch when you see either the Labor Party or the Liberal Party on TV, they're all defending coal mines. It doesn't matter. Both sides. One's being funded by the coal, the companies of the Gina Reinhardts of the world, and the others being funded to some degree from the coal unions. So you have this dead hand of the past reaching out on both the side of labor and capital, saying keep on doing what you're doing. Now we know that's just that will destroy the civilization on which those profits are based. We simply can't allow it to continue. I would be setting up something which involved a transfer. It would not be a tax. It would be a rebate, whatever you'd call it, a transfer, partly which would be intended to maintain stability of energy prices for the poor, because energy is such a major consumption item for people who are poor. You know, the main thing they're doing is paying to keep their house warm. And then on the other side, those peaks and troughs would turn up pumping money into a fund which accumulated money over time for spending on research and development into alternative energy sources, and also for working out ways how we can reduce our energy consumption. So I want to see, you know, far less cars and far more buses on the road, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it would make sense, wouldn't it, that those companies that are, I mean, if you get the process right, it makes sense that these companies that have been around for a long time and do understand energy, it would make sense that they're the ones that are, you know, helping to drive this transition, if you get the legislation right, rather than saying, oh, well, you're the old school, let's get the new kids in. These companies have scale, they've got employees, they've got smart minds. You just need to change what their focus is, and they've got shareholders, you know, who are looking for a return. So the easiest transition would be to use these companies, wouldn't it?
That was the easiest way to promote a reduction in cigarette consumption too, wouldn't it? Give it to Philip Morris. Once you've got, you know, a huge source of profits like that, it perverts the mind, and very few of them are going to be thinking in a socially expansive system. If you'd done it 50 or 60 years ago, then yes, this would be possible, because over that time they would have been rejigged by the social responsibility that came with those systems. But internally, they're going to try to undermine you all the way through, because you're stopping us getting access to the honeypot.
Well, you're a politician these days. You must know that, you know, if you were to say, "Well, no, we're going to introduce a whole load of legislation which is basically going to kill your company, so all your shareholders are going to be that much worse off." I mean, that's not a politically smart direction, is it? You almost have to use them because it's a bit like, you remember in Australia when there was talk about splitting up Telstra, and there's all this concern about what it was going to mean for Telstra shareholders. It just became politically untenable. Same thing if you start saying to energy companies, well, we're going to introduce legislation which is going to stop you getting oil, and we're not going to provide you any funding for you to try and find alternatives. Then they are, you know, they are just going to keep on behaving the way they did before, or they'll shrink in size, and you will be politically unpopular as a result. I don't know. I feel like you've got to use them. But look, there's a crazy idea from the somewhat untalented politician Rishi Sunak, who's the Chancellor in the UK, the Treasurer in the UK, which is to subsidise the energy companies. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. So, your energy bill is going to be very large this year. So rather than saying, well, okay, let's give you 300 quid, they say, well, actually it was 200 quid, I think it was, we will give that money to the energy companies, so the energy companies can reduce your bill by 200 quid or not, as the case may be, to everybody. That's just a crazy approach, isn't it? Because the energy company is going to go, okay, well, that's reduced our costs by 200 quid, but look at what the market price is. It's extraordinarily high. We're going to pass that on to the consumer. Thanks, government, for giving us a bit of money on top of that, but we're not going to change our price any.
Well, I've seen a similar thing with schemes over in Australia about things called JobKeeper and so on, which were given to the companies, not to the employees. And then when it turned out that they had super profits through the whole COVID period, that money wasn't returned. So you give it to the poor, you don't give it to the rich. And this, again, the only way to think about tax, and this is why I jumped in earlier, is that it's a redistribution mechanism. It's not a way of financing government spending. The government spends using its own money creation power. So, but if you are giving it to the people that you later want to take it back from, it's when they're the wealthy, then you're compounding your own initial problem, because the reason that a lot of wealth has been accumulated is the wealthy are able to evade paying tax. So when the money is supposed to come into their accounts, it doesn't. Therefore, it builds up there, and they're the beneficiaries of government spending. You want that to be the opposite. You want to be giving the government spending to the poor. So it's crazy to say give it to the companies rather than to the consumers.
Well, do you know, it gets even worse. They're actually also saying that the companies can then get that money back in a year's time. So so the price goes – so the price doesn't move now, but the price goes up when those companies say, oh, look, we in effect we lent you 200 quid. Well, the government did, but we've got to give that money back to the government now, so we're going to charge you that 200 quid on your next bills when supposedly prices have come down. That just you know, just from bad to worse. It's hard to imagine that this man is in charge of the British economy.
Oh, but no, it's not. Joe, that's a typical bloody treasurer these days. I mean, and this is what I mean. With one reason that I think we have to. Oh, no, we have to. It would be incredibly desirable that we banned private funding of elections completely, and that was funded by government money creation. And like in Australia, that if you get more than 4% of the primary vote, in whether you're running for the Senate or for a House of Representatives seat, then the government currently pays $3 per vote, which means that the Liberal Party and Labor Party, who get something of the order of, you know, say one-third of the votes of the country, are getting $15 million from that. And that's a sensible thing, because you should actually make it $60 or $70 or $100 million for that amount, you know, rather than $3 per vote, make it $15 per vote or something of that scale, and then say that's all you can spend. You cannot take a cent from any private source whatsoever, and therefore you cannot be purchased, because what we've seen, and I've seen it on both sides of politics, is just it's money politics, and the people providing the money fundamentally in this country are the fossil fuel industries. And look what we've got. So get away from private funding. That would be but of course it's not going to happen, because you need people to pass the law who are currently being funded by private donations.
Yeah. Yeah, the system's broken, isn't it? What about what about Joe Biden's approach then? His answer to the oil price issue is to dip into the oil reserves, 180 million barrels of oil over 6 months. That's about a million barrels a day. They had about 48 billion barrels in reserve, so actually they could release a million a day for 130 years if they wanted to. Which does beg the question, why not release more? Would that bring prices down? Is that a smarter idea?
Well, that's pretty much using a commodity buffer, which was a common UNCTAD, the United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, which is a sort of progressive stroke left-wing element of the United Nations. It's normally with its head coming from a third world country. They've been pushing that for a long time, using buffer stocks.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite a sensible thing to do when you have a commodity like oil and like coal, whose demand is very volatile, and it also doesn't run according to the manufacturing rules that apply to other manufactured items. So this is where neoclassical theory is completely. You'll be amazed to hear that it's completely wrong on this point, because they presume that any firm producing more output has to do it with diminishing marginal productivity, and there is cost rise. That's completely false for manufactured goods. But there's a truth to it when you apply it to things like oil and gas and so on, because you've got there's a certain level of
there's so much land. There's only so much land.
There's land. It's also when you've got a resource and you've geared yourself up for producing at a set scale, you do face spot market price volatility, as we're seeing right now. Otherwise, this wouldn't be happening. You don't get spot market price volatility on manufactured goods. And in fact, as you increase the volume of being produced of manufactured goods, you reduce the unit costs, because the firm gets closer and closer to its optimal production scale.
Don't you hit the problem, though, that it's good for now. If he and as I say, he could actually go harder probably if he really wanted to make a difference, given that they have so much in reserve. But then he hits the problem that you've got to get those reserves back up again, which means that he's actually adding to the demand down the track.
Which, yeah, but that's, so, I mean, we're leaving aside the fact that it's something we don't want to use at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. The thing is, that's the whole idea of a buffer stock. You release the buffer stock when the price is high, so you're making a profit, in effect, even if you have, you're doing it to keep prices down, but you bought that oil at a lower price in the past, and then when the price slumps in the future, then you buy. And therefore, so the whole idea of a buffer stock is to reduce the volatility of those prices, and it makes eminent sense. But of course, again, the oil companies, strangely enough, argued against this.
Mm. Yeah, funny
actually,
that.
They make a fortune during those periods of high price spikes, and they didn't want to stop doing it. And then of course, they're not quite so vocal when the price has slumped. But that's a huge part of the opposition came from both conventional economists and the companies themselves.
Well, certainly, you know, the reason why Europe and and Britain included in that has got into this big problem with gas prices is because they basically got rid of all their gas reserves. So all their and that was a large part of that. And we've talked about this on the podcast recently, I think. A large part of that was because of the privatization that happened of the gas industry. You know, there's not a great deal of incentive for a company to say, well, okay, let's try and moderate the prices, because you know, if demand is higher than they can supply, then prices go up. They win. So if that's the basis, on that basis, why would they say, oh, let's keep stuff in reserve so that we can moderate that price? No, you know, we want to get the price rise, do our share buybacks, look after our exec packages. Thanks very much.
And that's the way they behave. So yeah, it's you know, you've developed a situation where the people you don't want to be controlling an essential resource are controlling it, and they've perverted the political process. And it does involve politics to change something like this. So we're stuck with, you know, rules being set by people who've been bought by the companies we're trying to control.
Yeah. All right. So windfall tax, yes or no? Sounds like yes.
Yes, but not a tax.
Right.
It's a windfall transfer payment. And it goes to build up, you know, money for research into alternative energy, and you have a buffer stock to minimise the price volatility, and you're required you have to make it possible for people to get essential energy in society. It's that. You know, the Madge, we can't forget Madge and all this, as at some stage we all may all be living at the level of Madge.
Yeah, well, that's...
Or is it Marge?
Well, both. We're playing to multiple audiences in this podcast, Steve. We don't really care. But, I mean, yes, I mean, that was going to be my final point, actually. In fact, so long as Madge, Marge, and I think Gladys was in there, so long
or
as
Midge,
they can...
perhaps, so we're talking...
And Midge, sorry. Whoever, so long as these dear little old ladies can actually afford to keep warm and they don't die midway through watching Pointless on TV, you know, so long as they've got enough to keep warm, do we really care if prices go up to extraordinary levels? Because it forces the rest of us to change our behaviour, which we know we've got to do anyway.
Yeah, and the people who know that don't work in oil companies.
Yeah, well, we'll leave it on that point, that's for sure. Okay, very good. Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Welcome.
Next time, another question of our times. Stagflation. Is it round the corner? How do we fix it? We'll look at the answers to that next time on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.